on 2FM. With Green Firm, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry, or snack. Natural protein, your way.
Mr. Jenny Green for her entertainment this afternoon. It's Tuesday the 26th of January. My electricity is back, so I'm back and this is Game On.
We missed you yesterday, Ruby. Coming up today, there's live action underway as the Premier League carries on without Lampard.
Respect the decision from Chelsea, of course, but a huge hug from Frank, and hopefully I can see him soon. He's disappointed a team like Chelsea after the good job had done in every country, so he's going to deserve it. But we depend on the results, not the way we played, not about philosophy or these kind of things or the projects. So you have to get results. If not, you will be replaced from a manager.
We'll also have Mark Langdon on European football, and in racing, we'll have last week's big race winner David Bass on Cheltenham Golds and going vegan.
It's hard to say, has it made me a better jockey, but has it made me healthier, sharper, possibly fitter? Has it helped me recover more quickly from injuries, falls? I think so.
And former Welsh international Alex Popham joins us to discuss his own battle with dementia after rugby.
When this is, I know there's going to be hundreds, if not thousands, of ex-players or wives or family members going, that's you.
Game on 2FM.
Now, if you want to get in touch, you can do so by texting us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM. Now, we are going to start with the big announcement. The RTE Sport Awards are on Thursday, the 28th of January on RTE1. And we can today reveal the nominees for the 2020 Team of the Year. Ruby.
Yeah, and first up are the Dublin Footballers. The Dublin Footballers claimed more historic success in Croke Park as they secured their sixth All-Ireland title in a row and their eighth in 10 seasons. It's just incredible. The Dubs' unbeaten in championship run now stretches back to 2014, a total of 42 matches without defeat.
Yeah, it's impressive. The second nomination is the formidable Dublin Ladies Footballers. They secured their four in a row after rallying in the second half to record a 110-15 victory over rivals Cork in the TG Carr All-Ireland final. The Dublin Ladies created their own piece of history on Jones Road.
Our third nomination is the Kilkenny Camogie team. They dethroned champions Galway to end a run of All-Ireland finals heartbreak, claiming victory on a scoreline of 114-111 at Croke Park. They had lost five of the previous six finals, but they weren't to be denied glory this time with this superb second half performance.
Number four is Leinster Rugby. Leinster continued their domination of the Pro 14 as they won a first ever three in a row in the competition's history. They also eclipsed their own 10 consecutive wins record, winning all 17 matches in a disrupted season.
Next up, it's Limerick Hurling. They ruthlessly overpowered Waterford to complete the perfect season and reclaim the All-Ireland Hurling title. The Treaty County won all 10 of their competitive games in 2020, claiming the league, Munster and All-Ireland titles.
And our final nomination is Shamrock Rovers. Shamrock Rovers claimed the 2020 SSE Electricity Premier Division title, their first league title since 2011. The Hoops became the first invincible league champions since 1927. I have to say, I think I probably speak for a lot of people when I say I can't remember when any of this stuff happened. I've no idea what months they were in. I know they were last year, but who knows? When did all this happen?
Yeah, right. So when did Dublin win the All-Ireland? This is you just being so blasé.
Feels like ages ago, though,
it
Ruby.
Does feel like ages ago. Yeah,
honestly,
I'm with you.
I'm judging it.
Imagine if Claire had won. Oh, she could tell us to the minute.
She could, absolutely. Probably still be down there.
I said everything on fixtures and events and everything was just turned upside down, so I can't put times on things.
But it
this
did
year.
Happen, and there are six good nominees,
yeah,
and the winners will be announced on Thursday night at the RTE Sports Awards, which take place live on television, I think, sometime after 10 o'clock on Thursday night, if my memory serves me right. I read that somewhere.
We were there last year.
We were. No
Sitting
invites this year.
Table. No.
No. You probably get on and Zoom, can you? Ruby, you've surely shot a bit, have you?
I did something for it, all right, yeah. No, it is, of course, obviously.
Don't reveal what you're not supposed to reveal.
Sorry, move on. Nothing to see here. You'll have to watch Thursday.
There's a goal already in the Premier League. Crystal Palace and West Ham kicked off at 6 o'clock, and Zaha scored after 3 minutes. So Crystal Palace are 1-0 ahead, 7 minutes gone in that game. And Newcastle lead, 7 minutes gone as well, nil all. And that one will be going live to that very, very shortly. But just staying on the topic of confusion of dates and times and fixtures, the extension of the COVID-19 restrictions looks like is going to delay the GAA's return to inter-county action until March. So we're not expecting the leagues to start until after that, because the return to play has to obviously go in line with the level 5 restrictions. So it looks like it could be March 5th before we're seeing any bit of return to action. But look, I think it's fair enough, everything that's going on. We're not going to start wondering and wishing and hoping. I think they'll get going when they can get going.
God love the players, though. Another Zoom session.
Yeah, and I think especially if, like, you know, with Inter County, there's often new managers take over as well, and so they're probably mad keen to get going too. Yeah. in different counties, and they just have to wait. And we spoke to Eddie Brennan last night even about the club situation and the difficulties of just trying to get to know players and to get things going and to build up that camaraderie and relationship, and you're just trying to do it in a different way now.
Yeah. It'll all happen in time, folks. Just keep thinking.
Philosopher.
The vaccinations are coming.
Eventually. So positive.
I don't know about positive. Your poor Olympians aren't getting the well. That's wrong too. I think that was an unfair headline on Mo Farah to say he was suggesting he was going to get the vaccinations for the Olympics. But Dr. Michael Ryan, who is Sligo born of the World Health Organization, has correctly said that there will be no prioritisation of athletes going to the Olympics. That frontline workers and those that need it will get the vaccinations first. I think that's right. I think I'm not so sure Mo Farah said as much as the headlines would make you believe. I don't think it was a Novak Djokovic moment for any manner of means. Marie, did you have any thoughts on it?
Yeah, I think it's a difficult one for Olympians, because obviously there's a lot of athletes out there who their whole life's worth almost has been trying to get to an Olympic Games, and they would do anything that they possibly could to get there. And if there was an opportunity for them to get a vaccine, I'm sure they'd be delighted. But I don't think you can argue with the World Health Organization's stance on it. Like, the vulnerable and the healthcare workers have to come first. But at the same time, from a purely selfish point of view, I would like to see an Olympic Games in the summer, and if it takes getting athletes vaccinated, I can see that side of it as well, but not ahead of the healthcare workers and the vulnerable. You just hope that maybe the vaccination timetables might speed up a bit and that they might get everybody vaccinated in time for us to have an Olympic Games. That's all. That's all I want.
The Olympics going ahead is going to split opinion anyway, though, isn't it? Like, already we've seen Sir Matthew Pinson saying that he doesn't believe it should go ahead, like one of the greatest Olympians of all time. So, of course, there's going to be, you know, divided camps into, and we've even seen that with the people in Japan. I think a survey said 80% of them would rather it didn't go ahead.
Yeah, but I think it's so far away. I think we have to be a little cautious in what we think should be on and what shouldn't be, and see how the vaccine rollout continues and how these lockdowns work, and then maybe make a decision. I don't think there's any need for rush decisions just yet.
One thing,
I know,
we
there's
do
a lot of organisation in the Olympics, and
you kind
of
have
to be prepared
well
to that, yeah, a few million at stake. But you know, you never know what might be after happening by July.
One thing we do know that's going ahead, Ruby, rescheduled racing in Turles tomorrow. What do you
with the big one?
Yeah, the big one. Let's go to the main event.
Which is it, guys?
It is the Horse and Jockey Hotel Chase, is it?
Well done, Donner.
Yes,
you got it right.
Top of the bus.
Yeah, no, it is rescheduled from Sunday. Yeah, Alaho looks like being a pretty sharp price favourite in there, where he'll face battle over Dayoon and plenty of his stablemates from the Willie Mullins team. But thankfully, the snow is gone in Thurles, and racing will go ahead tomorrow. Navan has been rescheduled for Friday, and Down Royal, that was cancelled today, will be on next Thursday. Imagine all that rescheduling in Donegal.
I knew you'd go
manage
there.
Sorry, but now, as a jockey, as you get closer to Cheltenham, do you become a little bit more cautious about the rides you get?
Not too far out. Yeah, like, you've the Dublin Racing Festival Saturday week and Sunday week, and You have a few more big meetings after that. Maybe early March you might get a little bit more cautious, but this far away you couldn't. You're just as likely to get hurt in a good race as a bad race. So, no, you wouldn't be too cautious just yet.
Okay, well, there are 10 minutes gone in the two Premier League games that kicked off at 6 o'clock. Crystal Palace and West Ham is now 1-1, but we're going to go to St James's Park to Stephen Goldsmith, who's at Newcastle United and Leeds. Stephen.
Yeah, we've had no goals here. We haven't really come close to it. We've just had our first half chance of the game. The ball was floated over from the right-hand side and it fell to Jack Harrison of Leeds, who was in a decent position inside the box, but he got it wrong and he sliced the ball and it went wide. And that is about it, really. Diego Llorente has made his first start for Leeds and he's gone off injured. He pulled up, so Pascal Struyck is on. Leeds are just starting to get on top of this game a little bit, but they haven't really created anything. It's still 0-0 here.
And both managers probably looking for the win. I suppose Steve Bruce under a little bit more pressure, though.
He's under massive pressure, Steve Bruce. He has history. He goes on these runs, and he did similar 10 miles down the road when he was Sunderland manager. Puts a good team together, and then just, you know, once the downwards momentum starts, he struggles to stop it. The same thing happened at Hull as well. So a lot of Newcastle fans not surprised by that, and I think that's why they're being so vocal at the moment.
Okay, well, we will check back in with you a little bit later, Stephen. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're back with ex-Wales back row Alex Popham on Living with Dementia.
Game on 2FM. With Green Fern. Snack smart with Green Fern's new high-protein snacking range, available in selected Tesco, Super Value and convenience stores nationwide. Game on 2FM.
Right here, right now. The Welsh scrum superior, Alex Popham, this time will score the try. The Fijians couldn't hang on, and Alex Popham scores the first for the Welsh, acknowledges the role that his fellow forwards played, and that's 25-8.
That was Welsh international Alex Popham, a ferocious competitor on the pitch, an abrasive and brave back rower who never took a backward step. But since his retirement from rugby, he's been faced with the biggest battle of his life. Alex has been diagnosed with early onset dementia, and he joins us now. Alex, how are you?
Good evening. Yeah, not too bad in wet Wales.
Yeah, I know you're there with your wife, Mel. Mel, who are you?
Hi, I'm good, thank you.
Alex, we'll chat about you know your emotional and mental well-being shortly, but physically, I know from playing against you, you've always been in top condition, and you're going to need to be at the moment. You've some big challenges coming up physically.
Yeah, definitely. We've got the Rugby Ride Challenge on Zwift taking place on the 6th and 7th of March to raise funds for our charity Head for Change. It's a 24-hour challenge, and you can sign up for Team Wales, Ireland, Scotland, England, or the rest of the world. And you don't have to take part in the full 24 hours, so don't worry about that. You can take part in 2-hour slots. I'm doing the full 24 hours. We've got Geraint Thomas on Team Wales, so we've got an advantage there.
That's handy.
There's over 100 ex-internationals from around the world taking part. We've got Simon Easterby, the current Irish forward coach, you know, defence coach now, taking part.
Paul Wallace.
Paul Wallace, Bernard Jackman. So we need some more Irish players involved, but also the general public more than welcome to sign up to
get
raise.
On the bike and cycle your miles for Ireland.
Donners, what are you doing? <laughs> <laughs>
I'm not doing a whole lot. I'm there if needed.
No, but I'm to step up.
They're basically just ask you. So I mean, you're obviously committing yourself to it there now.
Absolutely. I don't think I'd be able to manage 24 hours, and it's quite handy that it's on Zwift, because I think I would pick up about 12 punctures.
Well, it's actually you get 5 minutes in between each stage, so it's not the full 24 hours. You do get a 5 minute wee break in.
Oh, that's nice of you.
As long as he's fed, he'll be happy. That's all that Donica cares about.
That's Mel's
job. That's my job today. Refreshments and entertainment.
Alex, just we're going to go through the challenges that are ahead of you very, very shortly, but just in terms of the work that you're doing as well, and you know, kind of shining a spotlight on dementia and your own early onset dementia, how important is that for you to put yourself out there, to talk about it and to share your story and to do things like this?
Oh, it's hugely important. When I had my diagnosis in April, and I had sat on this Mel for 9-12 months and not spoken to my parents, Mel's parents, they were brothers and sisters, and I just thought to myself, I can't be going through this alone. And speaking with boys I played with, it worked out I wasn't, and unfortunately there's quite a few boys struggling, and it's about helping those, and that's what the foundation is about, because all the information out there on dementia is for granddads, people 60 plus, not for 40-year-olds.
I think everybody, Alex, was taken aback by your age and just how young you are, you know, like just early 40s. It just sounds so crazy that something like this could happen to somebody so young, and it does, and you're doing a great thing highlighting it. But just your first experiences of it, when did you start to get a little bit worried or realise something was amiss?
I think Mel would be the best one to answer that, because I was most probably putting it off a bit.
Yeah, I think, where are we now? 2021. Alex, I first forced Alex to the doctor in September 2019. But that was on the back of that year, really, leading up to that, me noticing some real characteristic differences in Alex's behaviour that had no real explanation. And Alex was sort of putting it down to, you know, it's stress, it's work, you know. But I knew there was something deeply wrong. And my biggest fear was I actually thought he had a brain tumour when I pushed him to seeing the GP and going for the initial test. And we were completely shocked and floored last April with the diagnosis we actually received. But it was things, you know, his short-term memory, mixing up words, forgetting a conversation we'd had 20 minutes earlier, concentration, focus, emotional outbursts, particularly irritability, which were really out of character for Alex. We've been friends for 30 years. We went to school together. So I knew these weren't, you know, this just wasn't Alex. I knew that there was something wrong, but didn't know what it was at the time.
Alex, we all come away from the games and we probably accept that we're going to pick up knocks and we won't probably move like we used to, but to have an injury that affects your personality must be so difficult.
Yeah, it is. But since my diagnosis, I'm always a person who's half full, or Mel says more than half full, in my outlook in life. And knowing now, and the things we've put in place with changing my diet to a 95% Mediterranean diet, so I'm only allowed one steak a week, exercising, I signed up to do an Ironman, that has a big benefit to my well-being, but also to the blood flow and the oxygen going to the brain, so hopefully that will slow down the progression of this, and just trying to look at it as positive as possible, really.
I was kind of thinking about a Mediterranean diet there and thinking, could be a few bottles of rosé involved in that, but obviously not with the sounds of the diet you're on.
Alcohol is the other thing, and actually Al had given that up before his diagnosis. Interestingly, and his neurologist at his diagnosis says that was the best thing he could have done for himself because of the effect on alcohol and the brain and inflammation. And so our priority is slowing this degeneration and dragging this out for as long as we possibly can. So, you know, sugar's completely out of your diet now. And we've learned a lot in the last 9 months, which is, the knowledge is power in that respect.
Alex or Mel, whichever one you would like to answer, but I was just looking at the figures, and the doctors estimated that you had somewhere in the region of 100,000 sub-concussions. And I was thinking about that from my own point of view. I used to be a jockey. I'm 41 years of age as well. I've kind of lived for 14,900 odd days. That's about 6 concussions per day, or sub-concussions per day of my life, or your life. How did they come to that number? Or what did they reckon was...
The math on that. It's the analytics of Alex's, you know, life, of his professional career, his playing career, and particularly looking at, you know, his training. It's not just the matches. It's a lot of that contact. Those sub-concussions occurred in contact in training. and looking at how many shots you were targeted to make per session. What do you call it, Al? Sorry, I'm not using the rugby language there.
Just contacts in tackling people, being tackled, hitting rucks, being wiped out of rucks, driving mauls. All those contacts are causing small amounts of damage.
Which, because it's a cumulative effect, ultimately, and 85% of those 100,000 subconcussions, they estimate, occurred in training. And when I ran the maths on that, being a bit of a maths geek, I just thought, hang on, there's something we could do here and do very quickly and easily in rugby without hugely affecting the game on a Saturday, but to protect the players.
So and you look at
the NFL.
Yeah, the NFL 10 years ago reduced the amount of contact they do to 15 in training to 15 sessions a season. They predominantly do those contact sessions in pre-season. So during the season, the boys are fresh. There's hardly any injuries from the contact, and they're ready to go come Saturday or whatever day they play.
The brain is then getting rested, and that was the way it was explained to us with Alex. His brain at times of his career was constantly inflamed. He was a big physical player, as we all know. There's a lot we can learn, and moving forward, it's our priority with this. We both still love rugby, and we want to protect the players, protect the current and the future players, but protect the game is just as important to us.
Look, Alex, you had a fairly long career. You played for Leeds Tykes in England. You were in France. You played with Brive, Wales. You played with the Scarlets, roughly 250 games, 33 caps for Wales in your professional career. That's 283 games. So you're saying by limiting the contact in training and trying to make that more for match time could hugely reduce the exposure to these injuries.
Definitely. And the sooner we can do that, the better for the current players.
And the rest of the bodies Al knew when he signed up, he happily signed up to, you know, walk away with the shoulder injury he did, etc. But it would also have an impact on protecting more of those day-to-day injuries as well as the head injuries, I think.
Because we have protocols in place now for things like HIA when we see someone being knocked clearly out. But Mel, it's those sub-concussions that we can't really see and that probably don't manifest straight away. I know from my own case that, you know, you could be symptomatic maybe 3 days later. And
absolutely.
Just for you there, Mel, like sometimes I didn't understand it till we got educated a little bit more, but there is traits that, you know, are symptomatic of concussions, like being irritable, grumpy, you know, were these things you noticed?
Yeah, I think Alex, until his diagnosis, was of the misunderstanding that concussion meant being out cold. Mm. As we've learned, 90% of concussions to the brain occur when you're conscious. And as you rightly said, there's an array of other symptoms, concentration, irritability, other things. It's not all always about being sick and dizzy. Education is another key purpose of the foundation that we're a part of and we founded, because and all stakeholders being educated there, not just the people playing the game, but everyone around them as well, and knowing what to look out for. And there's so much more we can do to educate people and then as I say, protect the players' brains a bit better, but protect the game we all love.
It's not funny, but just in a hypothetical way, from listening to Dunica for the last couple of years talking about concussions and things like that in racing, we always knew the difference. You're either unconscious or concussed, and there was a huge difference between both, because to be concussed walking around and not quite knowing what you were doing but heading about your business. So if you were getting sub concussions, Alex, on the pitch, when you would get up from a ruck or get cleaned out of a ruck or make a tackle, did you feel in any way dizzy, in any way groggy? Did you notice anything at all with each contact?
I can't really remember a lot of my career with regards. I just knew that if you did take a bang and you weren't out and it was just a bit of like heaviness, you just had some sniffing salts and carry on. That's what was done when I was playing. And I just think for what we want to get across is limit as much of the contact that the boys are still doing as possible. And the boys, this won't hopefully happen to as many boys in the future. And it's simple things like that. We want to bring in MOTs for players. So when they sign their first professional contract, they get base tested, the whole body, but including that is the brain scan. And then every year that is done like boxers have which again will make the game even safer.
And Mel, I think hearing stories like Alex is really important for people to take concussion and a head injury and just that excess amount of contact seriously. And you did a BBC interview recently, and it was really heartbreaking to hear you talking about the worries that you have for the future for Alex.
Yeah, I think, you know, this has turned our world upside down, as you can imagine. We had big plans for the future. We were planning a second baby ourselves. We've sort of had to make decisions to change all of that. But I've made my life's mission now to really try and change that prognosis we've been given. Neither Alex or I are willing to accept there's no cure, there's no treatment. We're looking at a 5 to 10 year management plan. When I'm looking at my 2-year-old daughter, I can't accept that. We've got to do something here. And another part of the foundation is research and bringing together the best brains in science and research globally on this. We've discovered in the last 9 months, through doing a lot of my own research and digging with the other trustees, there's some incredible work going on around the world in this area, in brain health, in interventions, etc. But they're working in silos. And people in different areas don't necessarily know what others are working on until things get published. So, you know, we'd love to, and that's going to be something coming out in the press next week, big announcement with our research part. That's a global initiative. But it's a call to action of, you know, anyone who's got any interest or knowledge in this area, come forward and be part of the solution and work together. You know, the brain is the person, ultimately, is the bit that sort of I keep coming back to. Without that, there is no person.
And I think without the stories as well, like the human stories, the real life examples, the likes of you, Alex, and in that BBC interview as well, just hearing you speak about your children and having to tell them, how do you tell your children something like that?
Well, that was why we actually thought the foundation first started back at the end of April, because there was nowhere for me to go. As Alex has mentioned, I sort of, you know, Google wasn't my friend at the time, and I started looking, you know, how do you tell two teenage stepdaughters about this? And there was nothing available to me. Dementia is seen as an elderly person's disease, mainly, predominantly, and then these are grandparents who have often grown-up children or who are retired. You know, we have companies to run, we have day jobs to do, we have young children to look after. So I was like, what on earth do I do? And I've been in some very tough board meetings, tough business meetings throughout my own career, and I'm not scared of a tough conversation. That conversation with Holly and Isabel is still one of the hardest I've ever had to have in my life. And that for me is something that I know we can help others and make a difference here. And one of the things we're going to do with Head for Change is connect these children and teenagers of the players affected. So they've got a peer group to talk to, of people walking in their shoes, who get it, you know. And
Isabel, my middle daughter, she had only told one person one friend about my diagnosis, because she didn't know how to approach it with a friend. So part of the foundation, we want to have the children feel comfortable talking about what's happened to dad, and then feel at ease in that environment.
And it's that peer-to-peer that they're there to help for each other, you know, from different families.
And even from my perspective, I'd had my own health issues in 2019, because I'd been bottling up all this emotional stress, what was going on in life, not even talking to our own families. And it was actually Frankie Lipman, Michael Lipman's wife, and I connected last year, and it was like kindred spirits. Our first phone call from Wales to Australia was 2.5 hours, and she used the phrase, oh my god, I'm speaking to somebody walking in my shoes, Mal.
Yeah.
And in some ways the relief, the reassurance, the being able to talk to. So another part we've created is our sort of family friend network for the wives, the partners, the people supporting these guys, the family around them.
Alex, we know the rugby network is quite tight. We go out and we knock lumps out each other, but when you come away from the game, it is quite supportive. Have you had much contact from ex-pros?
It's been unbelievable. The generosity, the love, the support. Yeah. People just want to help out, and that is the amazing thing about rugby. All my friends across the globe, living in New Zealand, Australia, Canada, have just said, how can they help? And that's the special thing about rugby. It connects people, and friendships for life, and that's why we still love the game. And yeah, want to get involved, want to raise money to help this great cause in Head for Change.
Alex, are you nervous? I read you said you don't want to be a burden on anyone. Just, you know, what's coming ahead? How are you about it?
I try not to think about it, if I'm honest. I'm trying to just think about the positive things I've got going on. I've got to learn to swim for the Ironman, so that's a big pressure.
I think, being honest, and Al is incredibly, incredibly brave. It took them 3 months to convince me to speak out and do the BBC pieces we did last year, but I had to do it for Alex because he was willing to be brave and do that. But we'd had 8 months by then coming to terms with the diagnosis, but I'll be really honest with you, in December it hit us like a truck again. And we had to take some downtime, just us as a family, at Christmas, because the reality that we are facing isn't going away, and we can invest our time and energy into all these positives and make the best of this bad situation, but that fear doesn't go away. And if I'm honest, there are sleepless nights that we both have, worrying about the future and what that looks like and what that means, particularly the children.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Mel and Alex, thanks so much for joining us on Game On. We can't, put into words what you must be going through, but we know in any way we can support and help, we certainly will. Thanks so much for joining
Thank
us
you.
On Game On. Thanks so much.
Game On UFM with Green Fern. Healthy snacking made easy with Green Fern's high protein on the go range. Available in selected Tesco, Super Value, and convenience stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. So there is a little bit of breaking news. Thomas Tuchel has been confirmed as Chelsea's new manager. He has signed an initial 18-month contract at Chelsea. He's going to get to work immediately. He is due to take his first training session this evening and then take charge of Wednesday's game against Wolves. We'll be chatting to Mark Langdon about that a little bit later on. And Donica, just listening to that Alex Popham interview there, for somebody who is around the same age of him and would have had quite a similar career span, and like you probably played a lot more international games than him, all right, but you would have been exposed to the same amount of contact. How does that feel?
Yeah, I'll be honest, it is rocking, Marie. And it isn't until you kind of chat to the guy, and I'll be honest, for me, it's chatting to his wife, chatting to Mel, and seeing what the family are going through. Because, look, I'll be honest, and Ruby, you probably know it as well, when you're in your sport, you can kind of get a little bit selfish yourself, and it isn't till you see the effects it can have on the people that love you and surround you. But it is a worry. It's such a worry. And look, I know we're making strides to make the game safer, and we need to. But at the moment, you have to wonder, you know, is the game in a good spot? And I think the things that he's probably identifying are real player welfare issues. And you know, you hear some of those stories of some teams that go out and knock lumps out of each other in training. And look, we have been lucky. I'll be honest, I do feel within the Irish setup there was always organised drills as opposed to mindless contact. But you hear some of the stories from other groups, and it's not healthy. But yeah, it's a worry. It worry me, and I think it will worry anyone in collision sports. Ruby, you know when you hear stuff like that?
Of course it does, Donnick, and I suppose the more you listen to those kind of conversations, the more you find yourself when you can't find your car keys wondering, is it me? And yeah, there's times when it is scary, and then you realise that you just didn't put them where you usually put them when you find them. Exactly. So look, it is obviously frightening and scary, and we wish Alex all the best in his future.
Absolutely.
So it's our third week here on Game On to look ahead at the Cheltenham Festival in March, and this week we are delighted to be joined by the man who claimed Big Brace glory last Saturday on First Flow at Ascot in the Clarence House, Chase, David Bass. David, how are you?
Good, thanks, Ruby. How are you?
I'm great, David, and I'm not going to lie to you. I didn't overly fancy First Flow in the Clarence House Chase last week against Palitterlog Defi Desai and waiting patiently, but you most certainly put them all in their place.
Yeah, obviously it was brilliant to go there and take on those horses and, and beat the reigning champion chaser. But as you say, he was an outsider, but I was confident he'd run a big race, but yeah, if I'm honest, I didn't really expect for him to put up a performance like that.
That's good. I thought I was the only one. But David, you obviously let him roll away from the stands in Ascot down to Swinley Bottom, and you rode him at those fences downhill, and he answered every question. You must be excited looking forward to March and what might lie ahead in the Queen Mother Champion Chase.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you were probably one of many people that thought I'd probably lost the plot down the hill.
I actually hadn't.
it probably looked crazy that I sort of went and took on Polifilo quite early, but I was travelling so strongly, and he got into such a good rhythm down the hill, and as you say, I was seeing a few strides down the hill, and it was good fun and a real thrill, and like you say, I can't wait to do it again in the Champion Chase.
I actually didn't think you were crazy, because Ascot's a funny track, and if you can get a lead down the hill to Swinley Bottom, it puts huge pressure on the guys behind you to chase you up the hill. Was that in your head when you were attacking down the hill?
Yeah, I suppose. I had planned on trying to take Polifilo on quite early, but I didn't. When I watched it back, I didn't realise we were as far clear of the others as we actually were. But obviously, knowing First Slow as I do, I knew he was a strong staying 2 miler. So, you know, I wanted it to be a real test at 2 miles. So it was sort of part of the plan, I suppose.
You're enjoying a great association with Kim Bailey at the moment. And last year you had Joy at the Cheltenham Festival on Imperial Aura, who looks like he's going to be one of the main protagonists in this year's Ryanair Chase. How is he since his, I suppose, unusual or not common error that he made in Kempton the last day?
Yeah, he's actually come out of that quite well, which is good. As you say, it was really unfortunate. He's normally a brilliant jumper. I mean, I don't like making excuses, because as you know, any horse can fall or make a mistake. But I'm convinced that he was a little bit put off by the shadow of the wing. But look, it happened, and it was very unlike him. So yeah, luckily he's come out of the race well, and. Yeah, we're looking forward to going straight to Cheltenham in the Ryanair and having a go. I mean, it looks a really competitive renewal this year, but I think he's a very progressive horse who likes Cheltenham, and yeah, we're confident he can run a big race.
Another horse, David, you've been in association with this year is a novice hurdler called Does He Know, who made a very uncharacteristic. I don't know what exactly he did in Newbury when he ducked out through the wing with you and then went back in and jumped the next hurdle loose, but he is obviously a pretty decent novice hurdler. Would you be thinking he could be an Albert Bartlett horse, or would yourself and Kim be thinking maybe a more Ballymore horse?
Yeah, no, and interestingly, we discussed that this morning. I probably see him as an Albert Bartlett horse. He's through a race, he's quite relaxed, and I see him. I see him as a strong stayer, so I would probably prefer to run the Albert Bartlett. But like you say, it was very, very strange what he did at Newbury. He got very wound up before the race in the preliminaries. He hit up a few times and got really on edge. So for whatever reason, he was very wound up before the race. We'll try and work on a few little things with him, and go back to Cheltenham hopefully. But he has been there. He's been there twice and won twice there. So yeah, if we can get his head right, hopefully he can run well there.
Yeah, you look an exciting horse, David. You're having an incredible season. You have 47 winners ridden this year, but you're not from a racing background. I mean, your mum was a vicar, your dad was a musician. You didn't ride a horse till you were 16. It takes a lot of work to get to where you are now.
I suppose it's been hard work, and like you say, I don't come from a sort of usual racing background. But I suppose I've been quite lucky that I've managed to be sort of, you know, ride for good trainers and ride decent horses. And yeah, it's been hard work, but I feel like I'm in a lucky position now, you know, to be riding good horses and at the top level. So although it's been hard work, I feel that I've been lucky at the same time.
You're no stranger to riding good horses. You did, of course, ride Sprinter Sacra and he's chasing Debut in Newcastle. So you've kind of always gotten on good ones.
Yeah, at Doncaster, yeah. I did ride Sprinter Sacra. A lot of people forget that, but I definitely don't forget that.
I was standing beside Barry Geraghty watching it and he was absolutely glued to it in the weigh room in Cheltenham. I don't forget it.
I bet Barry was. I bet he closed his eyes when I saw a stride at the last.
Possibly the fourth last. He was starting to worry about what was going on.
Yeah, I taught him everything he knew. I can't believe I rode him twice. I think I was a £3 claim at the time, and it was a massive thing for me. You know, for Nicky to put me on him. I don't think I'll ever ride a horse as good as him again, but that was unbelievable. I wish I could have had another go, but it wasn't to be.
David, I present this show with a rugby player and a jockey, well, former now, but we've had an awful lot of conversations over the last 18 months about food and diet, but you were the first vegan jockey that we've had on the show. Can you tell us a little bit about the decision that you made, why you made it, and what's it been like for you?
Yeah, an interesting one, really. I suppose I'm a bit of a eco warrior, as you'd call it, and I decided to do it for sort of environmental reasons to begin with, and then it's sort of grown from there. You know, I feel like it's beneficial as far as my health is concerned, and I feel a lot of benefits from it, but yeah, the sort of main reason was environmental, but it's been really interesting. I feel like my knowledge of diet and what I'm eating and what is in certain foods has got so much better since I've been on this diet. So it's different, but I feel it's quite beneficial.
David, just on that, it's a brilliant thing to do kind of environmentally, and that's your main reason for doing it. But with your work, you know, you have to be recovered and fueled, and do you find it good for you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to lie, it probably means I have to you know, work a bit harder on eating the right food and getting the right amount of protein and that sort of thing. I feel better for it, and you know, I feel like my metabolism has improved massively for it. So and you know, I'm quite sort of heavy for a jockey, and I feel like I find it easier to lose weight on this diet and to maintain that level sort of weight. So it wouldn't be the same for everyone, but I feel like it's working for me.
I'm just thinking, David, I'm running through my head here through all the different wearrooms I was in and the different canteens I was in. I can't imagine there's very much in a jockey's wearroom canteen for a vegan.
No, but they are making improvements. There's a few places that have had the odd sandwich and the odd wrap, but I wouldn't eat loads at the races, but I'd snack on nuts and a bit of fruit and things like that. But yeah, there's a few racehorses making more of an effort now, and I think sort of in the next year or two that you'd probably be able to get a vegan option anywhere. probably much to the disappointment of some of my colleagues.
Yeah, I can't imagine you'd be overly popular doing that day, Shane. But David, look, I wish you all the best in Cheltenham, and thanks a million for taking our call.
Thanks, Ruby. Thanks for having me on.
Cheers.
With Green Firm. Green Firm's new on-the-go chicken bites are natural, high in protein, and packed with flavour.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Now it is time to turn our attention to football. There were two early kickoffs. Crystal Palace are trailing West Ham 2-1 and Leeds United are 1-0 up against Newcastle. But the big story of the night is, of course, that Chelsea have got their man, and Mark Langdon joins us now on the line. Mark, the news is confirmed. Thomas Tuchel will be the Chelsea manager, 18-month contract and starting work straight away.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it'd be a brave person to suggest he'll get longer than the 18 months, given the way that Chelsea go through their managers. But I think it's a really interesting, exciting appointment for Chelsea. I know there's been some debate as to whether Frank Lampard deserved more time, but Thomas Tuchel is a much more experienced manager. You know, he did great things, really, in terms of developing young players at Mainz. He did really well, I think, at Borussia Dortmund. Just couldn't get to sort of topple Bayern Munich on a regular basis, but I think a few teams have failed in that regard. Won virtually everything he could in France, and then just fell short in the Champions League. But he reached the Champions League final with Paris, which is, you know, further than they've been before. So I think he's somebody that's going to bring an identity and a philosophy to Chelsea. And if you look at the statement that sort of came out yesterday about how they couldn't see sort of an improvement coming with Frank Lampard, I think that you know, Tuchel can do that. Very much sort of, I suppose he followed the path that Jurgen Klopp did, so with Mainz and Borussia Dortmund. And so he is somebody that, you know, plays a similar style of football, that counter-press that you see a lot of teams in the Bundesliga do. So I'm excited to see what he does with Havertz and Timo Werner and Pulisic, who all will have known him from their time in Germany, either playing with him or at least sort of, you know, that similar style of play. But I suppose the big question is, Tuchel got sort of relieved of his duties at Borussia Dortmund and Paris Saint-Germain because he couldn't manage up and he was forever getting involved in rows with his bosses. And there's probably not a more political club in the Premier League than Chelsea, so he may have to pick his fights a little bit more wisely.
You think, though, he'll have learned lessons from the past, though, and worked on those elements of his character and temperament, I guess.
He didn't. He didn't in Paris, and you know, it was the reason he left Borussia Dortmund. So maybe it is something that you pick up in time. And I think Paris is one of the most unique jobs, really, around, because there's a lot of people that you have to please in that job, and you know, it's not made easy with, you know, Neymar being a superstar and Mbappe being a superstar. But I think one of the real telling moments came in the summer when he requested a centre back, and the technical director Leonardo disagreed, bought a midfielder instead, Danilo from Porto, and Thomas Tuchel played Danilo as a centre-back rather than in his normal position in midfield. So it had got to quite a petty sort of stage of rows there, which I think will be difficult. I don't think he'll have the final say on transfers at Chelsea. They have people sort of that do that. So he does need to learn that. But either way, the way that Chelsea get through their coaches, it's probably not a job that he'll be doing for 4 or 5 years anyway.
Now, speaking of Mbappe, you just mentioned him there, and there's a lot of focus on whether he is going to go or stay at PSG.
Yeah, I mean, he was asked this earlier on in the week, just because Real Madrid are very interested. I don't know how they're going to afford Mbappe, but they are at least interested in bringing a player of that quality to the club. Mbappe was asked about his future. He didn't say, I'm definitely staying. He didn't say, I'm going. What he did say was that he needed to be shown by Paris that there was a project in place that could sort of excite him and take him to where he wants to go. I suppose Pochettino is one aspect of that. Keeping Neymar would be a second part of that job. But the squad squad, actually, it may sound a little bit silly, but the squad is light in areas because they spent so much money on the forward players, hasn't quite got the depth, and that was an issue for them last season. So I think he wants to see that, that Paris Saint-Germain sort of share the same ambitions as what he does before he signs a new contract with them.
Right, that was going to be signed with Barcelona. Did you see their extraordinary debts were revealed this week? Over €1 billion.
Yeah, it makes my finances feel a little bit sort of happier about them. Yeah, so over €1 billion euros in debt. The, I mean, in theory, yeah, you know, there's talk that they could go bankrupt, could go bust. I don't, I mean, that would be almost unthinkable for an institution like Barcelona to collapse. But it definitely puts them on dodgy ground. They're unable to... Barcelona pay their players twice a year. They're unable to meet sort of one of those payments that they've sort of deferred them. COVID definitely hasn't helped the situation, but this is a poorly run team for a long, long time in terms of transfers. You think of Ousmane Dembele, Philippe Coutinho being two. Coutinho, of course, they ended up loaning out to Bayern Munich. They're paying Messi an extraordinary amount of money
each
week.
Last year, what was he worth then? Why didn't they, like, does no one look at the books in Barcelona? Just
well, see, this is what happens. Because you're only allowed to be a president for so long, the president's on his way out, and he has basically just kicked the debt up the road. So every sort of player that has signed a new contract, the likes of Ter Stegen, the goalkeeper, they're not on a pay rise now. The pay rise will kick in 12 months' time. And so he, you know, is not, he's thinking of himself when he sort of gets these players to sign on for another year, but it will be somebody else's problem. So these sort of mounting debts are not going to be cleared very easily. They haven't got sort of saleable assets either, really, because if Messi goes, that will be on a free transfer. So you're looking around wondering how they raise money. Usually the sort of, you know, Real Madrid have found ways of raising capital in the past, and I'm sure Barcelona will be looking to do something that's equally balances the books one way or another. But it's a terrible state for a club like Barcelona to not be able to pay their players on time.
That's for sure. And I might add as well, they still owe $29 million to Liverpool for the signing of Coutinho. Mark Langdon, thanks so much for joining us. That is all we have time for. We have a really busy show tomorrow. We have the Six Nations launch. Lisa Fallon will be with us to look at all the Premier League matches. And we have the Republic of Ireland under-21 manager Jim Crawford. Carl Mullen is up next.